Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
I'm still targeting the recommencement of regular pre-recorded shows for Friday, although I did something very stupid, really. I didn't read all the documentation beforehand, although I would say in my defense the documentation available is confusing and not as complete as I would like it to be. GPT formatted drives have a different way of booting than MBR formatted drives, and so I have to do something to make what I have actually work. And I think I've identified what needs to happen, but it's going to take some extra work. Fortunately, when I partitioned these drives, I left some extra space just for such a contingency. Anyway, as it is, I'm going to pick up where I left off last time in Continuing the Nuclear Dialogue by Alvin Weinberg. Specifically, this is in his review of Non-Nuclear Futures, The Case for an Ethical Energy Strategy by Amory Lovins and John H. Price. And I left off at the bottom of page 166, where Weinberg takes exception to the author's somewhat extraordinary statements about plutonium and its toxicity, which simply are not borne out in practice. A friend of mine, her father was a veterinarian who worked on the hot particle study at Los Alamos, implanting microspheres treated with plutonium, glass microspheres treated with plutonium, into the lungs of various experimental animals, because the assumption was that if you inhaled plutonium dust, that the radiation would be powerfully carcinogenic. But what they found was that, assuming that you're not a smoker, it's very difficult to actually get the dust into your lungs and keep it there. It tends to be washed out by various normal respiratory processes, with a consequence they had to surgically implant, in some cases, these simulated dust particles in order to make them stay. Anyway, suffice to say, the results that they got did not bear out the claim. And again, we shouldn't be surprised. It's not as though Amory Lovins is an oncologist, after all. He may make claims about cancer, but he doesn't really know the subject. But that's typical of the whole debate about nuclear energy, that as debates go, the exclusion of subject matter experts is remarkable. It resembles, I think, Isaac Asimov's harshest criticism of democracy, that many people seem to feel that democracy stands for the principle that my ignorance is as good as your knowledge. But picking up the essay at the top of page 167. Or take the matter of the Emergency Core Cooling System, ECCS. Here, Lovins and I agree that whether or not the ECCS works in the event of a large double-ended pipe rupture hardly affects the estimated probability of a meltdown of a light water reactor. Most of the time, it is a slow depressurization that one must worry about. And here, the ECCS is merely required to provide additional flow in a system that largely maintains its integrity. Lovin's conclusion from this is that, page 61, a decade or more of official safety regulation has been misdirected, end quote. But the misdirection of official safety regulations is rather irrelevant. The main point is that the safety of LWRs does not particularly depend on whether or not the ECCS will work in the event of a double-ended pipe rupture. Why does not Lovins, having castigated official safety regulations, concede that in this respect LWRs are safer than we had thought? These are but two examples of the seemingly plausible technical distortions and selective marshaling of authority that fault the book. But having taken the authors to task for not presenting the case fairly, I concede that most of the questions that beset nuclear energy are unanswerable scientifically. The authors are correct in their insistence that whether or not nuclear energy over the long term is acceptable is as much, if not more, a social and human problem as it is a technical one. Our profound difference, aside from their having distorted the technical situation, centers around the answers to two questions. Granted that nuclear energy is imperfect, is it possible, and ought we not try, to improve both the technology and the social institutions to remove the imperfections? And is the alternative that is proposed, a, quote, coal-based fission-free bridge, unquote, to a solar world, to be taken as seriously as the authors claim? I believe it is possible to conceive a fission-based society that many opponents of nuclear energy would find acceptable. The fission energy system would probably require physical isolation, hence nuclear parks and or undergrounding, social isolation so that only the few people involved with fission would be subjected to strict security, and a dedicated long-lived cadre like the Coast Guard that would manage the fission enterprise. I cannot prove the reverse, but I believe it is immensely important to try to achieve it. But if we fail, then what do we do? Can we embrace the idyllic solar low-energy future espoused so glibly and surely by Lovins and Price and other friends of the Earth? How could 10 times 10 to the 9th power people on Earth have much hope in such a low-energy society? Can we really ignore carbon dioxide during the coal-burning fission-free bridge? The uncertainties, the social stresses, the difficulties of the ideal solar society are now poorly visualized. Just as Lovins and Price can conjure up problems of fission and present them in paradigms that are hard to refute, so can skeptics object to the Friends of the Earth low-energy solar option. While accusing the nuclear people of hubris for maintaining that an acceptable nuclear future is possible, the authors are themselves guilty of hubris for their bold assertion that, quote, high-energy futures are bound to be coercive and to offer less scope for social diversity and individual freedom, end quote, or for describing solar technology as, quote, reliable, sufficient for our needs, simple, transferable, flexible with respect to cultural and settlement patterns, end quote, but never seriously estimating what solar costs in cents per kilowatt hour or in limitation of human choice or modification of our way of life. The question ultimately has to do with which modification of our lifestyle is easier to contemplate, the solar low-energy decentralized society or a fission future which, in exchange for abundant energy, may require the changes I have outlined. As a longtime nuclear advocate, one against whom the authors inveigh mightily, I find this book intensely disturbing. Each of the issues the authors raised, with the possible exception of the net energy question, has already been raised within the nuclear community by thoughtful nuclear advocates. So much of the argument is at the border of science, or is even trans-scientific, that one cannot prove the authors to be wrong any more than they can prove the nuclear advocates to be wrong. The authors assume a heavy responsibility in advocating foreclosure of an important energy option before they have examined either the full implications of the alternatives or indeed of the possibility of constructing an acceptable nuclear future. I would hope that in their future writings they will recognize more honestly the grave uncertainties inherent in the future they espouse. And here's another review of Lovins. Review of Soft Energy Paths, 1978. Soft Energy Paths Toward a Durable Peace by Amory Lovins. Originally published in Energy Policy, March 1978, page 85. Amory Lovins is surely the most articulate writer on energy in the world today. In this, his most recent book, he displays a capacity for synthesis, a felicity of phrase, and a command of detail that is a true wonder. So persuasive is his mellifluous prose that I found myself carried away and all but convinced by his arguments. Lovins is a revolutionary in the tradition, though not with the doctrinal cast, of Karl Marx. Unlike Marx, he is a neo-Jeffersonian who sees in decentralized energy systems the true way to utopia. Soft Energy Paths, together with his other books, both written and promised, will undoubtedly constitute Lovins' Das Kapital. Already he has had much influence in the great energy debates. His views were evident in President Carter's introduction to the recent meeting of the International Nuclear Fuel Cycle Evaluation Group. Energy policy analysts cannot ignore Lovins. They must examine his position both in detail and in the large. He argues his case so articulately that his influence for either the right or wrong path is bound to be enormous. If he speaks more clearly than he thinks, the energy community must know this. Lovins states both his purpose and conclusion at the outset, a comparison of the hard and soft energy paths, paths that are, here's a block quote, distinguished ultimately by their antithetical social implications. To people with a traditional reverence for economies, it might appear that basing energy choices on social criteria is what Kenneth Boulding calls a heroic decision. That is, doing something the more expensive way, because it is desirable on other and more important grounds than internal economic cost. But surprisingly, a heroic decision does not seem necessary in this case, because the energy system that seems socially more attractive is also cheaper and easier. End quote. Thus, in reviewing Soft Energy Paths, one must ask whether what he regards as the socially more attractive soft path is indeed cheaper and easier, and whether his utopia has much bearing on our real world. In short, whether Lovins, for all his crocheting brilliance, really knows what he is talking about. What he claims for the soft path, decentralized, non-electric, non-nuclear, largely solar, reads like a patent medicine nostrum. Here's another block quote. A soft path simultaneously offers jobs for the unemployed, capital for business people, environmental protection for conservationists, enhanced national security for the military, opportunities for small business to innovate and for big business to recycle itself, exciting technologies for the secular, a rebirth of spiritual values for the religious, traditional values for the old, radical reforms for the young, world order and equity for globalists, energy independence for isolationists, civil rights for liberals, states' rights for conservatives. If only one-tenth of all this were so, we would be bereft of our senses not to embrace Lovinsism to become energy revolutionaries ourselves. As readers of energy policy know by now, Lovins' analysis begins with an examination of end use of energy. Since most of our end uses require energy at low availability, it is thermodynamically inelegant to base the energy system on electricity. Of the energy finally used by society, not more than 10% requires electricity, electrochemical processes, industrial drive, illumination, and a few others. Essential to Lovins' position, then, is an almost religious rejection of electricity. In assuming this position, Lovins ignores electricity's advantages. His utopia is largely non-electrical, yet there is a mirror image of utopia based on electricity, since every end use that can be accomplished without electricity can also be accomplished electrically. The question is whether the advantages of electricity, its convenience, its cleanliness compared with decentralized fossil fuel systems, and its cost are worth sacrificing for the admittedly poor thermodynamic match with its end use and its possible social consequences if it is generated by fission. One of the fundamental issues is the role of conservation. Why, after all, do we aspire toward conservation? Certainly not because conservation is a transcendent purpose of our society. Rather, it is because raw fuel is in short supply, or because the environmental or even social impacts of energy production are undesirable. Since electricity can be produced at but 30% first law efficiency, to go directly to end use rather than through electricity would conserve fuel. But, in the long run, which is where Lovin's utopia is aimed, conventional fuels will have been depleted. And the choices between solar plus some hydro and geothermal on the one hand, and uranium or possibly fusion on the other, neither of which places much demand on fuel. The imperative for conservation in Lovin's world must therefore be sought not on grounds of fuel shortage, but on environment, burden of capital costs and other resources, and social desirability. As for the environment, despite Lovin's claims, a properly operating nuclear system is almost pollution-free. That there have been malfunctions of the system is undeniable, yet overall I would insist that the nuclear system has done adequately well. Lovin's simply denies the possibility of an acceptable nuclear future, and it is this belief which fuels his zealotry. I believe an acceptable nuclear future, that is, acceptably safe and acceptable environmentally, is possible, though I cannot prove our society will embrace such a future. But what is acceptable, that is, how much risk one is willing to take, must depend on the relative costs. At some cost increment, solar is surely better than nuclear. Can that increment be decided now, and our whole future preempted on the basis of Lovin's projections of the costs of solar energy? Lovin's is totally exclusionary. He does not admit that utopia can be a mixture of nuclear and solar, of centralized and decentralized, of electrical and non-electrical. For him, the paths are divergent and mutually exclusive. If we allow the hard nuclear path to get well established, we forever preempt the development of the soft path. Why is Lovin's so intent on destroying nuclear energy, rather than allowing it to compete in the various marketplaces with the solar alternative? His stated reason is that nuclear energy is unacceptable and can never be adequately fixed. But could it be that his claims that, quote, the energy system that seems socially more attractive is also cheaper and easier, end quote, or that, quote, the economic advantage of the solar over the nuclear system, even under Danish conditions, seems so robust as to survive any uncertainties in the cost calculations, end quote, in fact are nonsense, and that only by preempting nuclear on grounds other than economics can solar make serious inroads on our energy system? This certainly seems to be the case. Let us take the comparison of capital cost per daily barrel of oil given by Lovin's and quote it almost verbatim by President Carter in his talk before the International Nuclear Fuel Cycle Evaluation Meeting, Table 1. I'll just read this here. Capital cost of coal-fired nuclear and solar energy. Energy, the three columns are energy system, dollars per equivalent oil barrel a day, and barrel per day. Yeah, just in other words, dollars for each equivalent barrel per day of oil of a system, and then form supplied. So coal, $170,000, electricity. Nuclear electric light water reactor, mid-1980s, $200,000 to $300,000, electricity. Solar space heat, mid-1980s, no backup, assuming flat plate collectors and seasonal storage, $50,000 to $70,000, heat. I shall not quarrel with Lovin's coal or nuclear figures, although I would argue that the load factor he assumes in arriving at his nuclear figure is too low, especially when he ascribes to the distribution system the same low load factor he ascribes to nuclear plants themselves, and I am incensed that he ignores the difference between electricity and heat. Note that these days, nuclear power plants routinely achieve annual load factors much higher than those of the distribution system. So in places like France, where most electricity is nuclear, they actually have to be throttled back part of the time. On the other hand, his figure for solar heat is quite incomprehensible. Reports by MITRE and the Office of Technology Assessment indicate the ultimate cost of an installed residential solar heating system in a small building to be about $30 per square foot, against Lovin's estimate of $10 per square foot. Lovin's claims correctly that a solar collector in a sunny area such as Albuquerque, New Mexico, receives the equivalent of 25 watts per square foot, 270 watts per square meter, 24 hours a day throughout the year. Using his assumed efficiency of 0.42, the collector would deliver 10.5 watts per square foot, which corresponds not to $50,000 to $70,000 per equivalent barrel of oil per day, but to $208,000 per barrel per day. This generously assumes that 30 square feet, $30 per square foot, includes the cost of seasonal storage large enough to use every unit of delivered energy throughout the year. For more representative regions of the United States, the figure would be about $300,000 per barrel per day. And without the advantage of seasonal storage, the cost is higher because average collector yields are lower in winter. Indeed, if there's snow on the collector, there's zero. I dwell on this not insignificant point because it illustrates the great weakness in Lovin's economic arguments. He consistently underestimates costs of systems that he favors by selecting projections, not data, that favor his case, and overestimates the costs of competing systems that he does not favor. Moreover, he takes far too seriously his back-of-envelope estimates of costs, especially of systems that have hardly been tested. This is not a detail. It is almost the essence of the matter. The ultimate question, the matter around which the great energy debate swirls, is, can the sun replace uranium, or what is lost, what is gained if uranium is outlawed? Clearly, if our future energy path is based on an estimate of the cost of solar energy that may be 4 to 6 times too low, we embark on the soft path at the greatest peril. But Lovin's objection to the hard path is far deeper than economic. It is grounded in his conviction that the whole social structure is determined by the character of the energy system, and that a decentralized low-energy society is far better than the one we now have. It is therefore extraordinary that Franklin Roosevelt, in 1936, in his speech before the World Power Conference, saw in centralized generation of electricity with transmission to outlying areas the key to the decentralized society. Block quote. Sheer inertia has caused us to neglect formulating a public policy that would promote opportunity to take advantage of the flexibility of electricity, that would send it out wherever and whenever wanted at the lowest possible cost. We are continuing the forms of over-centralization of industry caused by the characteristics of the steam engine, long after we have had technically available a form of energy which should promote decentralization of industry. Has the world changed so much that white is now black? Are we in an Orwellian never-never land, in which Roosevelt's vision has been discredited and must be replaced by that of the energy revolutionaries? Is the TVA area where I live, quote, dirigiste and authoritarian, end quote, because our electricity is generated centrally, though we distribute it through more than 100 municipal utilities and rural electric cooperatives? Does the bomb make a world without nuclear power, the peaceful utopia Lovin's claims in the last part of his book? Can he deny that the problem of nuclear weapons is not far from the problem of war itself? That a total rejection of nuclear energy, as he suggests, far from making war, and in extremis, therefore, nuclear war unlikely, might exacerbate the tensions between nations without providing a countervailing stabilizing deterrent? Does Lovin's really believe that a renunciation of nuclear power will lead to durable peace? Lovin's, the revolutionary, must remember that revolution is usually strewn with disasters entirely unforeseen by its prophets. His insistence that utopia is to be achieved only by rejecting nuclear energy, or indeed centralized electricity, that utopia somehow cannot be forged out of a combination of centralized and decentralized, nuclear and non-nuclear, electrical and non-electrical, this is far too strong medicine to be taken at face value. Unfortunately, the social forces that Lovin's unleashes by his brilliant back-of-envelopism, neither he nor his opponents will be able to control. Let us hope that common sense as well as social inertia will conspire to maintain our society on some middle road that embraces all ways to salvation from energy catastrophe. The next review is simply entitled Response to Amory Lovin's, 1980. Because this is a response to a review by Lovin's of a publication with which Weinberg was intimately associated. First published in the New York Academy magazine, The Sciences, February 1980, page 13. Amory Lovins, the enfant terrible of the energy left, once again slays his favorite dragon, centralized electricity. In his review of the Institute for Energy Analysis study, Economic and Environmental Implications of a U.S. Nuclear Moratorium, 1985-2010, he all but ignores its main finding, that the United States could survive a limited moratorium with fewer economic or environmental impacts than the nuclear right had assumed. Instead, he beats the drums for his favorite syllogism. Electricity is bad, central electricity is worse, and central nuclear electricity is beyond redemption, an evil that must be extirpated. His argument rests on two assertions and one hope. One, that electricity is poorly matched to end uses, most of which require heat or liquid fuels for transport, not electricity. Two, that electricity, whether coal-fired or nuclear, over the period 1985-2010 is likely to be much more expensive than our alternatives, particularly gas and oil, not to say solar energy. Three, that conservation and solar energy will, during this period, drastically reduce the demand on fuels in the United States. Let me speak to each of these points. That conservation is extremely important goes without saying. Conservation has been proceeding in industry for at least 5 years, and significant progress has already been made. For homes, incentives are in place, and a start has been made. But as Roger Staubach and Daniel Yergin point out in their best-selling Harvard Project report, Energy Futures, conservation depends on countless decisions by millions of individuals. It is entirely unhelpful for Lovins to point out that houses can, in principle, be converted into solar-heated thermos bottles, and that therefore conservation in houses already built will be easily achieved. One could, with equal relevance, point out that the minimum energy required to desalt seawater is some 300 times lower than the energy used in actual desalting installations. For every price of energy, there is an economic optimum, dictated by the play between capital costs and energy costs. The useful issue is not what is the theoretical minimum energy required. It is how much energy innumerable consumers making individual decisions will conserve in response to higher prices or to government policies or to improved technologies. All of us are in the dark as to how much conservation we shall have. Perhaps the most sobering analysis of the future of conservation in the household sector was that given last year by Peter C. Roberts of the Department of the Environment in the United Kingdom. He estimates that if one takes into account that the poor adopt conservation measures much less readily than do the rich, then in the United Kingdom, not more than 34% of the theoretical conservation achieved by retrofit will be in place by 2005, even if fuel prices double. Thus, one must recognize that promising enormous savings by conservation does not guarantee that they will be achieved. For Lovins to quote the lowest of the Committee on Nuclear and Alternative Energy Systems estimates of energy demand in 2010, 58 quads, which assumes maximum conservation, without at the same time mentioning the highest estimate, 136 quads compared to about 79 quads in 1979, is hardly unbiased. And if one insists on quoting modern energy analysts, one should then point to the 95 quads in the late 1980s of the Harvard Project and the 100 to 140 quads by 2000 of the Resources for the Future study, both issued in 1979. One ignores the RFF estimate at one's peril. After all, the senior author, Samuel Schur, was the only soothsayer who in 1955 correctly predicted the 1975 energy demand in the United States. Measured against these estimates, the forecasts for overall energy demand in 2000, given by IEA, 101 to 126 quads, are not unreasonable. For 2010, 115 to 150, they are probably too high. These estimates were made in 1975. The energy demands in the ensuing 4 years have tracked the IEA low estimates surprisingly well. Moreover, despite Lovins' aversion for electricity, it has encroached on other forms. In 1965, it represented 21% of the U.S. primary input. It has grown to 30% in 1978. Are the people, who, after all, choose which form of energy they use, impossibly benighted? Why do they not follow the siren call of Amory Lovins to reject electricity in favor of other forms that conform better to his conception of the good society? Decentralization is good, or to his attachment to the thermodynamic imperative of matching the temperature of the source to the temperature required at the point of end use? The answers are simple. If oil is in short supply and electricity fueled by coal or uranium is abundant, then it makes sense to heat with electricity, even with the thermodynamically objectionable resistive heating. Thus, Lovins to the contrary, Electricité de France is not acting irrationally, nor are its customers, when they choose nuclear electricity to heat homes in order to avoid continuing dependence on Arab oil. Nor can one be convinced by Lovins' economic arguments. He, of course, tells only part of the truth in comparing the cost of a British thermal unit from resistance heating with a BTU from a gas or oil-heated stove. Though, even in this comparison, one must adjust for the actual efficiencies of individual furnaces. Indeed, if the gas or oil is eventually produced by conversion of coal, the overall efficiencies are quite comparable. But he makes far too little of the heat pump, the device on which much of the IEA expectation of encroachment of electricity depends. In 1977, 500,000 heat pumps were installed in the United States, some five times more than were installed in 1970. Thus, even though electricity, when used for resistive heating, violates the fashionable dictum derived from thermodynamics, match the source to the end use, there are many other considerations that make it at least as plausible as not that it will continue to encroach on other forms of energy. Not the least of these considerations, but one not mentioned in the IEA study, is the electric car, a technical development that seems always to embarrass the energy left because it fits poorly with their conception of a decentralized, non-electric society in which transport is based on alcohol derived from plants. I put aside the profound difficulties pointed out by Paul B. Weiss and John F. Marshall of Mobile Research Corporation of getting more energy from ethanol derived from corn than one puts into it, let alone at a cost less than 2.5 times the cost of synthetic fuels from coals. But one cannot ignore the announcement by General Motors of a Chevette powered by a zinc battery with a lifetime of 30,000 miles, a range of 100 miles between charges, and a cruising speed of 50 miles per hour. Nor, if one is really concerned about the environment, can one ignore the improvement in the quality of the air, say in Los Angeles or in downtown Washington, should the electric car become the backbone of our commuting fleet. Far from electricity being irrelevant for transport, as Lovins asserts, it could take over the major share of our most troublesome transport, the personal vehicle traveling to and from work. Is it clear that, over the time contemplated in the IEA study, electricity will remain much more expensive than oil and gas, as Lovins seems to imply? Considering that gas and oil are depleting reserves, and that coal and uranium are very much more abundant, this seems unlikely. At any rate, the IEA study suggested that the price of electricity by 2000 would have increased by a factor of 1.65 in constant dollars, the price of oil 2.4 times, of gas 10 times. And judging by Saudi Arabian Sheikh Yamani's recent proposal to peg OPEC oil at $40 per barrel, these seem, if anything, to underestimate the relative future price of oil and gas compared to electricity. At any rate, almost half of all houses built last year used electric heat. Apparently, many American householders see in electricity a more reliable source of energy than oil or gas, not to speak of solar energy. The IEA study came to what was, for the time, a surprising conclusion, that the United States could withstand a limited nuclear moratorium, though this would put great pressure on coal. Despite Lovins' criticism, this remains a reasonable conclusion. Does this mean that we are thereby justified in closing down nuclear energy in favor of Lovins' thermos bottle houses and his ever-shining sun? To my mind, the answer is no. Any of us whose fortune it is to outlive our earlier predictions, a fate thus far hardly accorded the useful, the youthful Emery Lovins, must recognize that seemingly robust predictions have a way of becoming downright sickly, if not moribund, as time passes. Thus, as I wrote in An Acceptable Nuclear Energy Future, The Sciences, December 1977, it is only prudent for us to design an acceptable nuclear energy system. Then, even if neither Alvin Weinberg's nor Emery Lovin's visions of the future are correct, our children will have an additional source of energy to use as they, not we, judge best. I'll mention, incidentally, that it is International Women's Day today. And, of course, I can mention Marie Curie, Lise Meitner, Dixie Lee Ray, who was the chairwoman of the United States Atomic Energy Commission, also governor of the state of Washington, I believe. There's a tendency in certain quarters to cast nuclear energy as an excessively or exclusively masculine enterprise, and to tell people that if you're, you know, a feminist, for example, you have to oppose nuclear energy. Personally, I think this is more of these hijacking tactics that certain people like to engage in. All right, well, I'm going to continue on with these reviews since they are quite interesting. Next one is entitled The Lilienthal Plan, dated 1980, originally published in Across the Board, October 1980. Review of Atomic Energy, A New Start by David E. Lilienthal. 15 years ago, in his Change, Hope, and the Bomb, David Lilienthal voiced great skepticism over the technologist's assurance that a 1,000-megawatt pressurized water reactor was safe enough to be placed in Queens, as was then being proposed by Consolidated Edison. That's the Ravenswood plant, which wound up being built instead as a fossil fuel burner. I would love to put high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, which have a high degree of inherent safety, in that spot, because with their high operating temperature, they can both generate electricity and supply heat to the Manhattan steam grid. For his heresy, Lilienthal was harassed by the nuclear establishment, particularly the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. I myself, in Reflections on Big Science, which appeared in 1967, was prompted by Lilienthal's attack on nuclear energy to come to its defense, even to the extent of predicting, erroneously, that nuclear energy would be too cheap to meter. Now that's interesting, because ordinarily that's a phrase associated with a speech by Admiral Louis Strauss, chairman of the AEC, in the 1950s, well before anybody had any reasonable cost estimates, and he was talking about fusion, not fission anyway. Of course, as I've remarked before, too cheap to meter doesn't mean too cheap to charge for, and we do see in places like Ontario, where the grid is mostly driven with low variable cost sources like hydro and nuclear, that metering rates, right, the rates that they charge are higher in periods of low demand than they are in periods of high demand, which suggests that it would make more sense to just charge people a fixed fee rather than per unit of consumption. Although there are also conservation-based arguments about system loading to take into account there. Change, Hope, and the Bomb identified the first chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission as the most influential of the anti-nukes. Atomic Energy, A New Start, by contrast, is an impassioned renewal of faith in nuclear energy, or more accurately, in the ingenuity of human beings to set nuclear energy right. Lilienthal argues that despite Three Mile Island, we cannot do without nuclear energy. Even now, Chicago gets 50% of its electricity from nuclear reactors. To shut them down would be catastrophic. And he has little patience with the radical call for panaceas such as solar energy. Even conservation, which it is almost blasphemous to question, is not without problems. No, says David Lilienthal, we must fix nuclear energy, not extirpate it. And fixing nuclear energy is not beyond the capacity of smart technologists. David Lilienthal's book centers on the development of a new reactor that is intrinsically more forgiving, to use an expression coined by P. Fortescue of General Atomic, than are the current light water reactors. He has little doubt that technologists, probably young enthusiastic ones, not old weary ones, will come up with the safe reactor if only they've set their minds to it seriously and are given sufficient support. Recognizing that development of such a reactor would at best be long drawn out, Lilienthal urges in the meantime various institutional fixes that would give us better organizations and better operators. He has very high praise, as do I, for the improved nuclear organization TVA has recently put into place. Lilienthal's fixes for nuclear energy parallel those I suggested in my article, Can We Fix Nuclear Energy? Across the Board, August 1979, but the emphasis is different. We both agree that more powerful operating entities are needed, but Lilienthal seems to minimize the role of siting policy in assuring safe operations. He opposes remote nuclear enclaves as leading to an unacceptable nuclear elitism among the operators of the plant, whereas I see the large nuclear center containing many reactors as a means to achieving the stronger organizations we both deem necessary. And I remain unconvinced by Lilienthal's arguments against nuclear enclaves, as we already see exactly such enclaves in existence. Ontario Hydro has three large nuclear sites, Pickering, Bruce, and Darlington, each with eight reactors in operation or under construction. I'm sorry to say that Darlington never got past four. The second block of four was planned, but has never been built. They really need it, though. The Pickering station has the best overall operating record of any nuclear station in the world, in no small measure because the agglomeration of eight reactors on a single site has invested that site with precisely the organizational and logistic strength Lilienthal and I both deem to be so important. Pickering, 20 miles from the center of Toronto, is not as remote as I would prefer, but it is a living example of how of the great strength and therefore the increased safety that can flow from a rational multi-reactor siting policy. Of course, I think Pickering is a good site because you can run a heat pipeline into downtown Toronto, which was seriously proposed in the early 80s but has never been taken up. But the main difference between Lilienthal's and my fixes is the emphasis we place on a development of a totally new, safe reactor. I agree that we should go back to the drawing board to try to do better, but where Lilienthal is entirely confident that we can do very much better than we have so far, I am agnostic. Try to design a safer reactor, of course. Base our future nuclear energy on the assumption that something much better will crown our efforts? No. It is curious that the man of affairs with immense experience in management should consider the technical fix, a safe reactor, central, and the institutional improvements, especially siting, less central, whereas this technologist considers the institutional fixes central and the technical fixes, particularly a better reactor, somewhat secondary. Why this strange reversal? The man of affairs betting on a technical fix, the technologist betting on more rational institutions? Perhaps it is that each understands his speciality best. With understanding comes an appreciation of pitfalls that are less apparent to the outsider. As a practical matter, Lilienthal's fixes for nuclear energy and mine may come to the same thing. While we await a safe reactor, we shall make the incremental technical and institutional fixes needed to prevent the present nuclear era from being aborted. Indeed, Three Mile Island has sent reactor designers back to their drawing boards. Present-day reactors will be safer as a result. If Lilienthal is right, and the totally safe reactor comes along, so much the better. The institutional changes may then turn out to be less necessary. But if the best reactor is not all that much better than existing ones, the future nuclear system will have to depend for its continued safety, and therefore its survival, upon institutional improvements that will have been put in place before we could have invented a very much better reactor. But all these are small cavils, Atomic Energy, A New Start, is an inspiring antidote for the technical nihilism that now enfeebles us. Coming as it does from the man who first correctly identified the main problem of nuclear energy, but who chooses not to be stampeded into a mindless rejection of this important energy source, the book should carry great weight. Though weary technologists might consider Lilienthal's technical optimism overstated, I cannot help admiring such faith in man's ingenuity. I hope the present generation, both of technologists and of nuclear policymakers, will pay heed to the good sense voiced by that remarkable American, David Lilienthal. Okay, well, we got 15 minutes. It's a difficult challenge to choose what to do next, but I'm just going to continue to the next review of Entropy, A New Worldview by Jeremy Rifkin and Ted Howard, 1980. Originally published in Population Development Review, Volume 7, Number 2, page 345, June 1981. I'm told that in the future the metadata files will be available when the repeater plays an episode, so I may go back and create those for these readings. Neo-Malthusianism has acquired a new catchword, entropy. First introduced into economic thinking by Georgescu Rogan in his remarkable book, The Entropy Law and the Economic Process, the idea is gradually catching on, if not so much among professional economists, then certainly among politically active environmentalists, anti-growthists, small is beautiful adherents, decentralists, solarists, in short, the new radicals, who are convinced that the Malthusian catastrophe is here at last, and its name is entropy. Entropy is a measure of disorder or randomness. According to the second law of thermodynamics, the world is inevitably headed toward a state of maximum entropy, that is, ultimate disorder and randomness. This, in its social and economic dimension, is Georgescu Rogan's entropy law. He, like so many of his disciples, especially Jeremy Rifkin, sees the inexorable working of the entropy law as pervading all of human existence, physical, social, psychological, and religious. There is no escape from its workings. Our current social and economic disorganization is a manifestation of the entropy law. Only by a total change in our way of transforming energy and of organizing society can we survive despite the workings of the entropy law. Entropy is a slippery concept. John von Neumann, perhaps the foremost mathematician of the 20th century, once advised Claude Shannon, founder of information theory, to designate the mathematical expression Shannon had devised to measure the amount of information in a message by the word entropy. Von Neumann gave two reasons. Quote, first, your formula is identical in structure with the entropy of statistical thermodynamics. And second, and more important, no one understands entropy. You will therefore always be at an advantage in an argument. If entropy is all that difficult a concept, why has it emerged as the unifying theme of modern Malthusianism? In truth, modern Malthusianism, with its stress on entropy, is to a degree merely a more accurate reformulation of classical Malthusian doctrine. Malthus argued that man increases his numbers geometrically, his means of subsistence arithmetically. Ultimately, his demand exceeds his means of subsistence. Many authors since Malthus have recognized that Malthus' views had a thermodynamic connection, since, in principle, energy can be transformed into all material goods, such as food, water, and fiber. The Malthusian dilemma has often been described as an energy dilemma. Expanding humankind would eventually outrun its energy resources. This is not quite accurate. Since energy can be neither created nor destroyed, we cannot be running out of energy per se, but only energy in a form, oil, gas, uranium, for example, that can be transformed into useful work. Such energy is described in thermodynamics a bit inaccurately as free energy, a term introduced by Helmholtz. free energy and entropy are closely related. The lower the entropy, the greater the free energy, and therefore the more useful is the resource. Thus, Malthus' energy dilemma is more accurately an entropy dilemma. What we lack, and what will eventually do us in, is enough energy at low entropy. What is new in Georgescu-Rogan's reformulation of the familiar Malthusian dilemma is his realization that the increase in entropy incurred in all human transactions often by itself creates difficulties. Pollution, too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and in a somewhat analogic sense, social disorganization, randomness, complexity, semantic confusion, anomie. Almost all of us, neo-Malthusian pessimists and technological optimists, are convinced that Malthus' original doctrine, as indeed Georgescu-Rogan's, is correct in principle. The Earth can sustain only so many people before the society will collapse, as was envisaged in the Limits to Growth report to the Club of Rome. This collapse, according to the original doctrine, was to be manifested in a shortage of free energy, that is, our non-renewable fossil energy resources. The collapse has not occurred, and most would argue that its avoidance represents the supreme triumph of technology. How much longer can our technology stave off the Malthusian collapse? Exponential population growth has to stop, but where? Is the 6 billion world population now projected for 2000 sustainable essentially forever, or must we eventually revert, as Rifkin claims, to a population of less than a billion? The issue becomes quantitative. Do we have enough free energy to sustain a very large population over the long term? Rifkin, and to a lesser degree Georgescu-Rogan, insist that once we use up our fossil reserves of free energy, we have no choice but to turn to the sun, an essentially inexhaustible source of free energy. A society based on the sun is, in Rifkin's view, a frugal society. There must be fewer people. These few will lead lives that are simple and are decentralized both politically and technologically. Rifkin more than flirts with the Buddhist way. Only a more contemplative, less frenzied lifestyle can be sustained by an energy source as diffuse as solar energy. Further, this way of life is uniquely moral because it alone conforms to Georgescu-Rogan's overarching entropy law. Georgescu-Rogan, in a 15-page afterword, seems less certain than Rifkin that the solar society can sustain even as many people as Rifkin contemplates. After all, solar energy sources demand equipment made of silicon and aluminium and plastic, and according to the entropy law, these too become dissipated and unavailable as they are transformed to human needs. For Georgescu-Rogan, there is not only a free energy, or entropy, dilemma, there is also a materials dilemma, caused by the dissipation of useful minerals into ever more dilute states of higher entropy. In this sense, he adds a material as well as a social dimension to the original free energy dilemma of Malthus. I am a technological optimist, one for whom Rifkin has only contempt. I cannot allow to go unchallenged three of Rifkin's, or more accurately, Georgescu-Rogan's primary theses. These are, first, that once the fossil fuels are used up, or abandoned because their use will cause unacceptable changes in climate, man has no alternative but solar energy. Second, that we are destined to experience shortages of mineral products such as metals, or concrete, or plastics, much like those we experience with oil. And third, that there is no alternative to semantic chaos and social disorganization other than a return to a less technological, simpler, and decentralized social order. On the first two accounts, I believe Rifkin and Georgescu-Rogan are more likely to be wrong than right. On the third account, I see at least one technological alternative that hardly figures in either Georgescu-Rogan's or Rifkin's thinking. As for energy, Rifkin's underlying assumption is the rejection of nuclear energy. This is so large an assumption and so little justified as to vitiate much of what Rifkin as well as Georgescu-Rogan claims. The breeder reactor is an inexhaustible source of energy at low entropy. Whether one fuels it with residual uranium and thorium in the granitic rocks or with the uranium dissolved in the sea, a breeder reactor system sufficient to provide most of the energy man will ever need can be sustained for millions of years. 10,000 breeder reactors could provide enough energy to sustain a population of 6 billion people at an average energy demand per capita twice as high as the current average of 2 kilowatt years per year per person. Is such a large nuclear system credible? Rifkin and many others dismiss the possibility. In so doing, they discourage the society from even trying to develop such a system. I can see that the nuclear system poses difficulties, but to dismiss it when the alternative is a low-energy Buddhist society in which time is sacrificed for decentralization and non-specialization, this I cannot do. If nuclear energy is deficient, fix the deficiencies, don't reject it. To categorically give up on nuclear energy is a denial of human ingenuity that makes no sense to me. To encourage us to give up on nuclear energy without expending every effort to make it work is immoral. As for Georgescu Rogan's insistence that we shall also run out of mineral resources, I can only refer him and Rifkin to the paper Goyler and I presented at the 1978 Helsinki meeting of the International Union for the Scientific Study of Population on, quote, the age of sustainability. Our main point was that 95% of the metals used by man, representing 80% of their aggregate value, were iron, aluminium, silicon, magnesium, and titanium. These are the most abundant metals in the Earth's crust. We shall never run out of them, even at high concentrations. As for metals like copper or mercury that are in more limited supply, there are many possibilities for substitution. And even if their price increases tenfold, the cost of an average pound of metal hardly doubles. Thus, although Georgescu Rogan is correct in principle in claiming that the world shall eventually be overwhelmed by the inexorable entropy law, whether or not we stabilize the population, the only relevant issue is when. In this generation? In 100 years? In 10,000 years? I see far too many technological possibilities to be overwhelmed by such pessimism, even though I agree that the world's population must stabilize. Finally, neither Rifkin nor Georgescu Rogan does justice to the extraordinary advances that are now occurring in the handling of information. How the chip and the microprocessor will change our society is at this stage anyone's guess. Can these devices restore order to a society that is now too complex to be governed, or possibly too complex to retain a modicum of stability? This I do not know. In any case, as a technological optimist, I believe it is at least plausible that the computer will turn out to be the solution to semantic chaos rather than being the problem. Oh, well. Rifkin's style is arrogant. He knows that he, as Paul to Georgescu Rogan, has a sacred mission, and that he cannot let facts divert him. He must demonstrate that the whole of modern society is rotten, and that this rottenness is not something transient or isolated, but is immanent and pervasive. It is all a working out of the entropy law. The chapter on medicine illustrates the poverty as well as the style of Rifkin's approach. Since, according to the entropy law, everything is getting worse, the health and therefore the life expectancy of our entropic society must be getting worse. To support the argument, Rifkin invokes authority. He does not verify his authority's credentials. It is sufficient that an authority, any authority, his thesis. Rifkin quotes studies that show, 1, that modern medicine, especially antibiotics, has contributed negligibly or even adversely to human health, 2, that, quote, most diseases are environmentally induced, page 180, and 3, that male life expectancy in the United States has begun to drop. But the data show otherwise. 1, granted that better sanitation was the primary step in the elimination of infectious disease, the knockout blow surely has been delivered by immunization and antibiotics. 2. Professor Higginson, the original proponent of the view that up to 90% of human cancer is caused by environmental agents that can be removed, has now retracted his earlier belief. 3. The life expectancy of a male reaching the age of 65 in the United States has increased by 2 years in the past generation. The pollution-induced catastrophe to human health envisioned by Rifkin and the entropists hasn't happened. But in this, Rifkin is not the only one to be faulted. Bureaucracies, such as the Council on Environmental Quality and the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States and comparable bodies elsewhere, are equally at fault. Unless the environment can be blamed for the alleged deterioration in public health, a prime raison d'etre for the existence of these bureaucracies is removed. And if these bureaucracies are weakened, what hope is there for the entropists to create a new society according to their vision for the future, a society whose ethical justification lies in its conformance with the entropy law? This society is the truly moral society, since it alone conforms with God's, or better, science's, supreme law of entropy. Okay, this is not quite the end of this, but There's like one more paragraph, and I'm not going to get through it before the end of the hour. So stay tuned for Evolution Revolution with DJ Damaru.